What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off. Will Clemente is a finance major at East Carolina University. He has quickly become one of my favorite writers on all things Bitcoin, including deep dives on various on-chain analytics. We're joined this week by David Puel, the OG on-chain analyst. You can subscribe to Will and David's work both by clicking on the links in the description. In this conversation, we discuss the history of on-chain analytics, what happened over the last few months, the current market structure outlook, and what to look for moving forward. I really enjoyed this conversation with both these guys, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up are my friends over at Revolut. Let's go back to the basics for a second. I've partnered with Revolut, a finance app in the US and the UK that say they're the simplest way to access crypto. They're putting their money where their mouth is too. You can sign up, make 3 card transactions, and get $15. That's right, $15. What can you do with the 15 bucks? You can exchange it for Bitcoin or any of the other tokens Revolut supports. Yes, they are crypto enabled. These guys have made it easier to get some skin in the game. As usual, when you move your money from fiat to crypto, your capital is at risk. Sign up now through Revolut.com/pomp to get a $15 reward and put them to the test. Revolut.com/pomp. Go check it out and you'll get that reward. Next up is Kraken. For the last 10 years, Kraken has been one of the best platforms for trading crypto online. Now, with the new Kraken app, it's easier than ever to buy and sell Bitcoin and over 60 of the most popular cryptocurrencies on the go 24/7. Simply download the Kraken app, connect your bank account, and start investing for as little as $10. Just a minute is all it takes to get started. With the new Kraken app, you'll have your portfolio in your pocket wherever you go. Monitor your investments, track winners and losers, keep tabs on your favorite projects, or view the most traded cryptocurrencies of the day. It's got all of the features you need with none of the complexity. It's a simpler way to invest in crypto. Visit kraken.com/pomp now to learn more, or search Kraken in the App Store. The app is amazing. Go check out Kraken in the App Store or visit kraken.com/pomp today. Last but not least is Amber Group. With low yields and looming risk of inflation around the world, it's no question crypto is the alternative. With Amber App, you can easily earn high yields on your crypto assets. Amber App is an all-in-one crypto finance app designed to help you earn, swap, trade, and invest in crypto. You can earn interest instantly simply by depositing assets to your wallet, and you receive daily interest payouts. You can also customize fixed-term investments between 1 and 360 days to enjoy higher yields with flexible redemptions. Whether you're a long-term holder or trading on market moves, on Amber App, you can earn interest on your own terms and do more with your crypto. Check them out at ambergroup.io or click on the link in the description to find out more about what they're offering. All right, let's get this episode with Will and David. Hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. Got a very special episode for you today. I've got both Will and David here. David, maybe let's start with an introduction from you. The audience knows Will, likes Will, keeps coming back, listening to Will, but maybe you can give us kind of a quick overview of your background and then what you spend your time doing day to day.
Hey, Pom, thanks for having me. So I've been involved in Bitcoin pretty much full time since 2017, I guess. Dabbled in since 2015, but pretty much very minimal amount. My original background is actually literature. I have a major in Spanish literature, but I turned into finance mostly because of Bitcoin. I went into finance a little bit in 2016 and then mostly in 2017 when I pretty much went down the rabbit hole in Bitcoin and all that stuff. First from a technical analysis perspective, and then from on-chain analytics, which is what I'm the area out of which I'm most known for in the space. I've created several industry-wide use metrics in terms of indicators based on on-chain data. I was a co-founder of Adaptive Capital, which closed last year. And since then, I've been pretty much, independent researcher and trader on my own. Recently published a three-part series with ARK Invest on, you know, as a manifesto of on-chain analytics for the regular institutional and retail audiences that ARK Invest has, and have a few other research pieces coming up, and that's about it.
Awesome. Will, maybe I'll let you kind of take the lead with some of the questions around the on-chain data and what David's seeing.
Yeah, sure. So, David, I guess we could just start with, you know, what do you think about, you know, kind of the evolution of on-chain? I know you kind of really dove into it heavily in, you know, around 2018. You know, kind of talk about the evolution of on-chain, you know, the early metrics and kind of where it's where it is now, and then kind of where you see the space moving in the next perhaps, you know, 5-10 years.
Well, I think if we go back to history, it's been very interesting, you know, as a research field in general, you can actually track the history of it. I think it started 2016 and 17, mostly out of Willy Wu and the Coinmetrics team led by Nick Carter. They pretty much are the first wave pioneers in the whole thing. I think I'm more from the second wave. So the first iteration of it, most people know it by now, is NVT, which is a metric. It's pretty much inverse velocity. It's a way to track velocity on the network, which, you know, is not that useful in terms of signal anymore. But after that, I think with Nick Carter's publication on realized capitalization, I think that metric specifically pretty much brought on a huge golden age, you could say, or at least first wave of massive, very brilliant minds from all backgrounds getting into the space, trying to analyze Bitcoin and the data science behind it to try to get a sense of the inner economics of the thing, right? From a data science perspective. So I guess I was one of the second wave pioneers in that golden age, created the MBRV ratio and a few others. Now I think we're in a third, in the data service provider wave, you could say, where you have the Glassnode, CryptoQuant, CoinMetrics, WhaleMap, a bunch of very smart people trying to get an edge on the best metrics and the best insights into how to, you know, transform the data into reliable signals. That generates observer effects in and of itself. So that gets, you know, it's a kind of a race to the bottom sort of thing. So you have to, now we're at the stage where you had the pioneers, and now you have to figure out the way to remove the noise from the signal and stick to a better strategy if you're an active manager, especially. And also if you're just an observant, right? You know, capturing data from the blockchain.
So David, I want to ask you, you know, what kind of metrics do you look at? And, you know, just in general, what things aside from on-chain do you look at to kind of gauge your outlook on market structure, whether, you know, you're talking about specifically in a bear bull cycle, but just in a broader sense, what are those kind of, infrastructural things that you look like, that you look at to kind of build your base, and then you kind of look at more, zoomed in things to create a shorter term, you know, bias on the market, but what do you look at in a broader sense, I guess?
Okay, on-chain, in terms of on-chain stuff, I try to focus on metrics that somewhat determine the primary trend, which is quite difficult because in Bitcoin history, you don't have as many samples as you'd like, you know, as opposed, you know, compared to the Dow Jones or the S&P or whatever. It's just a 12-year history. So I think for the most part, you know, several oscillators like the MBRV ratio are quite useful in terms of getting a sense of, in a very wide range, if you're under or overvalued.
Can you just explain for listeners what MBRV is? I think there's a lot of people that aren't even sure what that is. And then also touch on the Z-score version as well.
Yeah. So MBRV it stands for market value to realized value ratio. Is divides market cap by realized cap, you know, And what it means is it compares the current market capitalization. It compares it to the cost basis of the whole market in realized cap. So realized cap is, as opposed to market cap, where you multiply supply times price, right? So you give the current price to each coin in the total circulating supply. You give the price where that coin last moved. So that in aggregate creates the cost basis of the market. It means the point where on average, every buyer bought their Bitcoin. So it creates like a sort of a mean reversion mechanism where you can compare current market cap with that mean. And it's usually very reliable in terms of detecting overextension or, you know, some exuberance in the market. And when it goes below that, when market cap goes below realized cap, the cost basis, it's usually, you know, the time where it's a great, great spot to accumulate, where, you know, when most people are at a loss, where most holders in the market are at a loss, that's when you should be buying, you know, as in any market. So I usually track of that in terms of on-chain. In terms of swing movements, I like SOPR, which is spent output profit ratio, which compares the price of the aggregate of coins when they were, you know, last moved, or the price where they were spent, right? So it's very hard to explain this on a chart, but without a chart, but it's basically trying to track how many people in the market are in profit or in losses at any given time. And whenever you're in a bull market as a primary trend, whenever you go back to break even, the ratio goes back to one and resets at break even. That's usually a very good signal that we've bottomed. And in bear markets, most people are at loss, right? So whenever that ratio goes back to break even from below, it's a very good signal that we top. So that metric gives you a very good sense of bottoms in bull markets and tops in bear markets. But apart from on-chain, I always track funding rates, specifically derivative premiums or discounts on the perpetual contracts. I think that's, with a couple of on-chain metrics, that's the most reliable signal in the whole market. And it's very well known.
If I could just punch in real quick, you know, what are your thoughts about funding here? Because it looks similar to March. I don't think it's been as deeply negative as it was after March. But we have had, you know, overall a general cluster of negative funding. So do you think that we've reached, you know, a long enough period of that negative funding, or do you think we need to see, you know, a big drawdown in that?
Well, I've always said there's like three main rules when analyzing funding rate or perpetual premium or discount. First rule is the longer the deviation, the wider the deviation, the better the signal. We got that huge deviation. I mean, the widest one was in the COVID collapse, right? It was like a $1,000 deviation in terms of price delta between the perpetual and spot price. Right now, we have a very healthy deviation. The second rule would be the longer the signal, the longer the regime, meaning negative regime or positive. What I mean by negative regime is when derivatives price is well below spot price in those perpetual contracts. That's very good because it signals that one or two things, or both, that, you know, there's one, there's more demand for spot than for contracts, which is very good. That's why the price of spot is above the price of derivatives. And the other one is that if there's an overabundance of open interest in the market in those contracts, most likely those contracts are shorts. So in terms of liquidity, it's very bullish as well, right? So either are, like, whatever the case may be, whether the circumstances are setting up in the spot market or in the perpetual contracts, it's bullish either way, right? And if you add that open interest or open value in terms of BTC, you can track whenever there's going to be an explosion. Most likely that explosion in volatility is going to follow whatever regime we had the month before that, or the couple of weeks before that, right? So if that funding regime was negative, such as right now, most likely we're going to go up and vice versa. And the third rule of funding rates, or premium specifically, is that I think it tells more a story about spot than a story about perpetual contracts. Most people think that, oh, most people are short, but therefore we're going up, but it's just because people are short, because the market is over-levered. I disagree with that. I think whenever you have very long, like right now, we've had a month and a half at the very least, period of negative funding and negative premium across the board in Binance, in BitMEX, in Bybit, and you know, in aggregate metrics I use. It pretty much denotes an over demand for spot above anything else, right? You see the same thing with expirational contracts when you go into backwardation, but backwardation in Bitcoin is much more scarce than negative funding in the perpetuals. So for the most part, I think it's more useful as a signal because it gives you a direction one way or the other most of the time. And I don't know, so far, despite any, you know, possibilities of an observer effect in the market on that particular metric, I haven't seen it fail since pretty much middle of 2018. So let's see what happens.
David, how much of this is kind of the metrics when they meet macro environment, the metrics prevail versus the macro environment? So obviously COVID's a kind of a perfect example where you get a bunch of folks who are watching on-chain metrics or starting to learn about it. And then out of nowhere, COVID happens, there's all this monetary stimulus. Do you have thoughts in terms of the relationship between maybe like macro or external factors versus on-chain metrics and how you kind of balance those two things? Or do you feel like the macro ends up being worth understanding, but really the on-chain metrics continue to survive regardless of what the tailwinds of the macro environment are?
Well, it depends on what type of mindset you have. If you're a day trader, you know, just look at order books, right? If you're a swing trader, I think funding is and a couple of on-chain metrics are very useful, despite whatever macro thing may be setting up. If you're an active manager, you know, on a Wall Street type mindset, I think macro and on-chain are pretty much your giveaway. With a little bit of funding rate, I do think funding rate works in all timeframes and all mindsets. I think it's a very important descriptor of market activity in a very visually synthesized way. So to give you an example, previous to the COVID collapse last March, in hindsight, obviously, you could see a severe increase in funding rates going to positive, right? And you can actually see a lot of the price deltas in coming out of China, Chinese exchanges, going through the roof in the sense that most of the West was buying. So the prices in Coinbase tended to be higher than the prices in Huobi or OKX. And on top of that, there was more because, you know, the Chinese were the first ones to start pricing in COVID and going into cash from risky assets in general. And on the other hand, also, you saw a very prolonged, almost a month. It was almost a month of sustained positive premium on BitMEX and most derivative exchanges. Meaning, you know, that perpetuals were more expensive than spot, usually a very bearish signal. And, you know, after that, you know, the market collapsed 50-something%. So I think that both on-chain and funding rate in general, I think they help you, one, confirm a lot of the macro theses you may be diagnosing in the market as an active manager, because, you know, most active managers are the thing that they use. And, you know, day traders and crypto speculators, they don't care about macro that much. So if you're in that mentality, I think macro, your usual set of tools for macro analysis, macroeconomic analysis, that's one. And then, you know, analyzing the liquidity of the market and on-chain as an inner economics lets you confirm your macro thesis. And even more important than that, it also gives you, it synthesizes a lot of information that you as an active manager, sometimes it's very hard to grasp because you're trying to synthesize a lot of sources and interpret them in your mind. And I mean, some active managers are extremely, extremely good for that. But what they do, you know, just looking at derivatives premium, just looking at a few metrics that SOPR or MBRB or a few exchange inflows and outflows or minor outflows, stuff like that, it gives you a sense to, it synthesizes the inner economics of Bitcoin quite well and lets you take action in a more educated way, you could say.
David, I want to ask you, so, you know, just kind of walk the audience through your perspective on, you know, the bull run and then kind of where we've got to the point where we are now, you know, kind of the key drivers that pushed us up, you know, the cash and carry trade, Grayscale, and then, you know, some of the things that kind of accelerated the move down, such as, you know, the liquidations. So, you know, do you see, for example, like, you know, the Chinese miners, do you think that played a huge role in the push down, you know, things like that? Just kind of walk us through from the, you know, early bull run to now.
I think the Chinese, it played some. It played a part, but I think the most important factors were, you know, pretty much just institutionals taking profits. They saw, you know, 2x, 3x, whatever in returns on a, you know, in less than 6 to 8 months. So, and they're not fools, right? You know, they just take profits. That's the way they think about everything. So that's one. And the other one is, you know, the GBTC trade, arbitrage trade unfolding pretty much. You know, as long as that premium persisted, that trade was profitable on the, you know, unlocking periods, depending on the unlocking periods the clients had. And as soon as premium started, you know, going negative, that pretty much collapsed the, you know, first it suggested some spot selling for sure. But more than that, it, you know, collapsed the incentives to go into that trade and start, you know, adding new money and new capital into the market. So I think that was the major role in the collapse. After that, I don't think the Elon tweet, I mean, the Elon tweet was the trigger, right? But at that point, I think most institutionals had taken profit at that point. It was a 3-month window to do it. So I think they were pretty comfortable about it. I do expect a lot of movements like that, where, you know, a lot of the liquidity modeling that goes into forming tops and bottoms in the market is going to be much more tempered. You already saw that in 2019 and 2020, but I think it's going to be even more substantial now, where, you know, the incentives to suppress in liquidity or volatility for the longest period of time in order to getting in other positions, major positions, I think that's going to make the incentives for wider consolidation periods in tops and bottoms. Let's see what happens. Yeah, that's pretty much my
piece. So how do you see exactly, I mean, you kind of touched on there, but, you know, how do you see institutionals kind of changing the shape of the market where, you know, Bitcoin has been majority retail driven for the longest time? You just talked about, you know, the suppression, but aside from that, is there anything else that you think is affected by institutionals being involved in terms of market structure? And then I also want to talk about the volatility that you just touched on. You know, we're kind of in this really tight volatility band here. I think that the previous two that were this tight were when we originally broke down from 65K. And then before that, in like late July of last year, that kind of propelled us into the bull market. So, you know, if you have any comments there.
In terms of whether, I think your question in summary was, are we in a bull market or a bear market? Something like that. I think so far I've seen a lot of friends that have gone extremely bearish, very bearish. I think, I mean, the most reliable signal in the market is bullish and has been bullish for a month and a half now. On-chain, if you see a few metrics, if you track, you know, stuff like volatility adjusted MBRV ratio, a bunch of metrics that give you oscillation, we technically never were at such levels of exuberance as 2013, 2017, those tops, way, you know, a few months ago when we were back in, you know, 60K or so. We didn't see that. We did see some overextension in the market, but not at you know, late 2017 levels. So that's one. The other one, a lot of midterm signals in on-chain, like SOPR, for instance, are signaling right now that we are very neutral. Like the market is, like the primary trend hasn't been defined, but funding rate is quite bullish and has been for a while. So even if we go to, let's say, 27, there's still a very high, a very decent possibility, let's just say, of regaining some momentum to the upside. Now, if we get rejected at, you know, whatever, 48 to 55K, whatever point of resistance in that, at those levels, and then collapse from there, that would be a lower high, and that's very, you know, a very high likelihood that the trend is down for the midterm basis for the rest of the year at least. In terms of cyclicality and timing, you know, if you start to count time after the market bottom in 2018, late 2018. And then after the halving day, in terms of cyclicality, we haven't technically topped. That should come at the end of the year, November or something. But, you know, that we don't have as many samples in the history of Bitcoin to argue that with high conviction, right? So as of now, I'm just taking it step by step. I'm personally bullish in the short to midterm, even if we go to 27. At the very least, I expect a decent dead cat bounce. And then I'm going to take it day by day at 48, 55 and all that stuff. Look at, you know, the usual metrics. And then if we get rejected, that's pretty much bear until 20K. If we don't, we go to all-time high. That's pretty much it. I'm just taking it day by day.
Do you see... you know, at least my personal view has been that we're kind of in this reaccumulation phase. I know Willie pretty much agrees. And then Checkmate also has recently been talking about getting some kind of supply squeeze. Do you see anything that suggests that as well? I was curious to see your opinion on that. You know, looking at like a liquid supply ratio, you know, exchanges trending down, you know, looking at like liveliness trending down, showing, you know, more Coinbase being created than destroyed, like some things like that. Do you see that similarly, or do you have a different opinion?
Yeah, I mean, liquid supply has been net illiquid, right? We've been net illiquid for like a month now, which is as opposed to like you know, at the top in the collapse when we were net liquid. I've seen your charts, the recent chart you sent me, dividing illiquid supply by total circulating supply, which is, it shows consistent reaccumulation in the market since COVID, nonstop, pretty much. You know, coins are just getting moved to illiquidity since then, in a way that hasn't been registered before historically. That's very healthy. So all things point towards the same, you know, signals we saw below 20K last year. Price action, however, has been horrible, absolutely horrible. So, but I guess that's part of the fun, right? You want to make things look as awful as possible before, you know, leaving everyone behind. That's just the way markets work.
It almost seems like there's this divergence where you have this kind of underlying accumulation, especially over the past couple of weeks, but then price keeps trending down. And like, I don't know, when I go back and look at some of these things in like September or even like in, you know, January on a smaller scale, you had the same divergence, but not nearly on the same magnitude that we have now. So I don't know, maybe you think differently, but the way I see this is like the larger the divergence is, once that information gets priced in, the larger the squeeze will be, if you will.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. The only point is, you know, being correct about the diagnostic, right? The divergence. Yeah, but I do agree. The divergence is quite large at this point, you know, meaning the divergence between price behavior specifically and on-chain, fee on-chain activity and funding rate, right? For the last month and a half or more. Yeah, that's been, I think that's been the craziest divergence I've seen since, I don't know, but not even COVID, because in the COVID collapse, you still had a huge capitulation, right? And a huge mark of, okay, there's a great likelihood that this is going to be a B bottom, right? This is going to bounce because the drop was just massive and quick and violent. Premiums went haywire. On-chain was haywire. Apart from COVID, there wasn't a fundamental reason. And then once you had the stimulus and the inflationary hedge narrative, that was pretty much, you know, an easy ride from there. And that was just a year of nonstop uptrend, right? Some consolidation, some chop here and there, but it was nonstop uptrend from 5,000 to 60,000. It was insane. So of course you're gonna have drawdowns like this. That's one of the reasons why I wouldn't be surprised that we may go to 48, 50, 55, something like that, and then collapse back to 20K and retest the all-time high. You know, the multi-year all-time high level. But, you know, who knows?
So, David, in that scenario, I think that's a really interesting thing. And this is probably the number one question that I see people in the comments whenever Will and I talk about on-chain metrics is they're trying to figure out, you know, should they be trading via on-chain metrics? Should they just be dollar cost averaging? How do you think about the on-chain metrics themselves and what you see there versus the applicability to trying to pick up more Bitcoin? And I think that you just brought up a great point where if you said to somebody, hey, you know, we're sitting around 30,000 today, Bitcoin is going to ride up to $45,000, $55,000, then it's going to collapse to 20,000, then it's going to go back to an all-time high. That is immense volatility compared to traditional assets. And so right. If somebody knew with perfect foresight and certainty that that's going to happen, obviously what you would do is you'd buy at 30, you'd sell at, you know, 55, you'd buy back at 20, and then, you know, and kind of play around with that volatility. But obviously nobody knows. And so how do you think about potential scenarios versus what you actually do with capital?
Well, it depends on one, your time frame, and two, the role in the market you want to take. Do you want to be a permanent holder? That's fine. Just sell your coins 10 years from now. That's fine, right? I'm sure there's going to be some adoption in the next 10 years, right? if you're an active manager, meaning setting up spot or even, you know, some margin trading, some leverage trading with low, very low leverage, meaning less than 1x leverage. And you want to play around with that as an active manager or in that mentality, and maybe take positions that last at the very least a few weeks to months, and you have the temperament to hold that and just, you know, devote yourself to your day job and your children or something, you can do that. And that would be very useful, right? Maybe you can take some, accumulate some here and maybe assess some on-chain metrics and funding and a few technicals or whatever at 55. And if it doesn't look good, you sell, right? Or some portion of it, whatever. And then go back to 20, keep some dry powder and all that stuff. It depends on your time frame. And it depends on your, if you're a day trader, just look at the order books and just play around and do 40 operations per day. It just depends on the role you want to take on the market as a whole. And I think every role is fine, and the market needs every single role. To retail investors, I recommend, I don't know, it's hard to recommend. I don't want to make financial recommendations. All I can say is if you want to be in Bitcoin, you do have, you know, exposing yourself to the asset and the risks and volatility therein or lack thereof. I think it's a crucial part of your Bitcoin experience, because that's the only way, when you have skin in the game, that's the only way when you can gauge your own psychology against the asset. And you can manage your exposure better. You can manage your time devoted to analyzing Bitcoin in general better. And you can analyze, you know, you can keep track of when did you make the best and the worst decisions and iterate upon that. And I think it's very different for every single person. I think some people just don't care and just want to hold. So I think just going discreetly with a wise position into the asset, if you want to go and start experiencing yourself, even if you lose money, is a win in terms of getting your psychology used to how Bitcoin works and behaves.
Got it. And I guess one other question in kind of the same thought process here is, when you talk about something where at 30,000, you know, you wouldn't be surprised if it went to 45, 50,000 and then back down to 20,000. Is that all within volatility of a bull market? At what point do you say, hey, maybe we're not in this bull market where people were thinking we were going to see 100, 200, 250, you know, $500,000 price points? Just how do you think about that volatility with the backdrop of, you know, kind of the repricing after a halving and kind of that bull market thesis?
Well, if we stick to the bull market thesis, ideally, this would be the bottom, this or 27 or something like that. And then we go to all-time high and then top at, you know, 100, whatever. And then we have the real collapse and maybe go back down to 20 or 40 or whatever in the time span of a year or something, right? That can happen for sure. That's the way Bitcoin has behaved in the past. You can also have localized primary trends, as we saw in 2019, where you have the plus token era, right? That's a good way to put it, where price went from 3,000 to 14,000 in the span of about 6 months, and then it collapsed from 14 to 6 and 6 to 10 and 10 to 5 with COVID, right? So in that whole period, you had a Ponzi scheme in China restricting the supply off the market, creating an artificial appearance for demand, which wasn't going on. Like the truth is, there wasn't that much new money coming into the asset, as opposed to just a bunch of Chinese getting scammed in China, getting into the asset. So that drove a mini bubble, you could say, into 14K. In the span of a few months. And then you had a mini bear market cycle where you had, you know, the unfolding on the plus token scheme, where the CCP confiscated all those funds and was pretty much selling it into the open market via Huobi and OKX. That's verified via on-chain analytics. And after that huge amount of supply, which was at the time up to 200,000 Bitcoins, it's, you know, 1%, 1-2% of the supply. The market was liberated from that oversupply. And then after that, you had the whole, you know, COVID getting priced in to pretty much all assets in the world. So I think unless there's huge gray swans like that, like plus token or COVID, whether known or unknown, because I mean, the plus token was, we should have known when it was happening. It was mostly word of mouth when the top was already in. So it was just about tracking those coins and seeing how much were sold already to get a sense of, okay, that's done. We can like continue with the uptrend now. And with COVID, it was just like, you know, suffering a period of 2 or 3 days of absolute collapse and then recovery. Unless we have that, we should be on a fundamental way in a primary bullish trend. I haven't seen even institutions FOMO that much. In fact, I do think they took profits quite diligently at, you know, between 50 and 60K. So there's no the same intuition that makes me think that they took profits at those levels gives me the intuition that they would be accumulating here and at 20K, because that's how they think. So far, I don't see the evidence of the primary trend being, being a more than 6 months of downtrend, you could say. But who knows? I'm taking it. As I've said, one thing I've learned over my years in Bitcoin and analyzing and, you know, keeping my eye in the chart for several days at a time is that you need to take it day by day and make your decisions accordingly. It's very hard to predict a year in advance, even if you're very, very sure of certain factors. Sometimes you have black swans, gray swans, and they pretty much, make your whole thesis disappear and quickly. So take it day by day.
I want to ask you, so, you know, how can people get involved in understanding on-chain? Some of this stuff might sound really interesting to people that we talk about every week, but I want to kind of give you an opportunity to give some resources, because you're actually the first person that I hit up when I started trying to, you know, get into this stuff. It was originally, I watched a video of Willie on McCormick's podcast, but then that same night I DM'd you, and then you told me to like check out Glassnode Academy and play around in Excel and stuff. Do you have anything else that, aside from those two things, you know, how can people kind of get involved in the space?
Well, I think fortunately for most people, you have very good people to follow, you know, such as Willie, Checkmate, Nick, and even the guys at Glassnode or CryptoQuant. I think most of the information has been neatly packaged in all the data service providers. The most widely used are, you know, CoinMetrics, CryptoQuant, Glassnode, and few up-and-comers like WhaleMap, and I don't remember which other, but I think those are the main ones. Some of the services are a bit expensive. So, you know, once you have skin in the game, I guess you adjust the value for that information. A lot of them have free metrics that you can explore to see, you know, if they are useful to you. And I'm not sure if CryptoQuant and Coinmetrics. Glassnode has an on-chain academy of sorts where you can actually track every metric with a very deep explanation of on what it's actually tracking, how it's calculated, and how you can actually use to extract some signal out of it. So yeah, it's pretty much just going to the main service providers, data service providers, and explore their websites. Most of them have very good descriptions of each metric. And in the case of Glassnode, at least from what I know, you have a full, you know, academy on the whole thing.
And David, where can people find you on the internet if they want to learn more?
You can follow me on Twitter and Medium at Kenosha King. It's not Kino Shaking, it's Kenosha, like the city. King, like the, you know, like a king. Kenosha King, that's my handle. I pretty much keep updates on what I do there. So it's the easiest way to follow me.
What is the significance of Kenosha?
So that's a very good question because nobody ever asks. It's actually the play on words on a Thomas Pynchon phrase, the Kenosha Kid from Gravity's Rainbow. I'm a big fan of Thomas Pynchon, so it's just taking the Kenosha Kid and put it the king in there.
King is better than the kid. I love it. Yeah. Will, where can we send people to follow you on Twitter or subscribe to your newsletter?
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to, you know, first say thanks, David, for coming on and, you know, putting up with me, like bombarding you with charts all day long.
Give them going, bro.
You guys saw our conversation. You just see it's like pretty much me sending him like 5 or 10 charts in a row, and then he'll just comment back on what he thinks of them. But anyway, on a serious note, you know, appreciate you and, you know, thanks for kind of communicating back and forth with me. And yeah, so I'm on Twitter at W Clementi III, and then I also do the weekly newsletter with Pomp, and then as well on my Substack, you can find that in the link in my bio. It's BTC by WC3 .substack. But I want to ask you, David, are you doing anything else with ARC, or are you guys done with that kind of series you were putting?
We're publishing part 3 in the next few days to weeks. I'm not sure the date, but it's coming up in the next soon.
And is it like each one you're like progressively going deeper and deeper into the different metrics, or because I remember like the first one you did was just like really broader, just like HODL waves and stuff like that.
Yeah. So the way we wanted to set up that whole piece is it's an on-chain manifesto, but it's pretty much just trying to divide the different uses, the different mindsets and roles of market participants, as mentioned by Pomp and yourself. It's trying to bring, you know, if you're just a stakeholder or an observant, right? If you're a Mike Green of the world that maybe tracks some Bitcoin data, but it's not exposed into the asset, those are the metrics for you described on part 1, right? If you're a holder, part 2, and now it's going to be more for active managers. Just as, you know, ARK and Cathie Wood, they are active managers and they have a different mindset on how to think about Bitcoin. So the part 3, it's mostly for active managers, which is different from traders, actually. Traders think very different from active managers. So it's trying to going from the broader to the narrower. And part 3 is going to be mostly devoted to, it's going to have a few new metrics, brand new metrics that Arik and I have devised, and shows them as example of how active managers can use some of this very transform or very specific metrics to get some signal off the market.
All right, David. Well, listen, we really, really appreciate you coming on. Will and I have really enjoyed these conversations with the various folks, but you're an OG, man. You have been at the forefront of this for a long time, so we appreciate it. We'll definitely have to bring you back in the future and keep up the great work. Highly suggest people go follow you, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks for the invite, man.